Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Free in Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Nearly 2 months after the fall of Baghdad, the U.S. body count is still mounting, and U.S. soldiers are still on the move in force. At least 10 American soldiers have been killed by organized attacks from small bands in the last 15 days in occupied Iraq. Today, an American Army Apache helicopter was shot down by hostile fire. There are areas of progress, but this is not a textbook reconstruction. In some days and places, it almost looks like guerrilla war. And still, the lights don't come on. Tonight on Point, the American occupation of Iraq under fire. We begin in Baghdad, where the U.S. launched two substantial military operations over the last 48 hours with more than 4,000 troops responding to increasingly frequent attacks from stalking enemies. David Rode has been covering the occupation of Iraq for the New York Times. He spoke with us today from Baghdad. I asked him for the latest on the big American operations in the so-called Sunni Triangle north of Baghdad.
They've actually started a second military operation that's northwest of Baghdad. Americans planted a bomb what they are calling a terrorist camp. In the same operation, I guess you would call it Iraqi forces or whoever they were targeting on the ground, shot down an American Apache attack helicopter today.
So now there are two fronts open. There were 4,000 troops involved in the first front. Are we seeing, David Rode, a return to major combat operations?
The military says no, but there's, you know, clear indications here that if it's not a return to major combat operations, there is clear evidence that the resistance here is at least becoming more effective at targeting and killing Americans. The Americans are responding with a much bigger military operation to try to curb it before it becomes a much larger problem.
These operations are in response to what appear to have been quite well-organized attacks. Could you describe them for us, give us a sense of them?
The attacks have shifted from basically like random firing at patrols to much more organized ambushes where flares are used or lights are turned off and on at a building. And basically there'll be initial fire from rifles of the first and last vehicle in a convoy, and then RPGs will be fired at vehicles in the middle of convoys. There appears to be reconnaissance done where attackers will figure out whether it's a heavily armed American convoy with armored vehicles in it or if it's more lightly armed with just Humvees, and they'll target the more lightly armed, less formidable convoys. This is a return to some of the tactics that were used effectively in southern Iraq in the beginning of the war, where sort of small ambushes were carried out against the weak points in American lines, the sort of resupply convoys.
David, does this mean that the United States is now engaged with a guerrilla war in Iraq?
I think we're approaching that, but I think it's premature to say that. You know, there's clearly been an increase in attacks, and the casualty numbers are way up. There's been 10 Americans killed in the last 16 days in Iraq, after only one American was killed for the first 3 weeks of May. So there's definitely an increase in the effectiveness of these attacks, and it, you know, time will tell, but there's definitely an organized resistance. I think the military is playing down the problems they're having here, but it's hard to say yet whether it's widespread. The key point here is that all these attacks are going on in an area that's dominated by the Sunni Muslim minority here in Iraq. They only make up 20% of the population. They've ruled the country for decades. Saddam Hussein himself was a Sunni Muslim, so you basically have hardliners from a group that makes up 20% of the population carrying out these attacks in one part of the country. It's not like this is going on all across Iraq.
Paul Bremer was on the telephone today with the House Armed Services Committee talking about the situation in Iraq improving dramatically. What might he be referring to?
There is an improvement in terms of the economic situation here in Baghdad. Gas lines have been reduced. I think there's a better sense of security here. Southern Iraq, actually, it turned out to be the most stable part of the country. Things appear to be going at least better down there. There's been much fewer attacks. That's an area that's dominated by Shia Muslims. They were violently suppressed and in many ways the worst victims of Saddam Hussein's rule. So Shias are thrilled to be rid of Mr. Hussein. So they, I think they have more patience with American Sunnis. You know, have lost everything in many sense, so they are already attacking Americans. The longer-term danger is that, and you hear these complaints from Shia Muslims, that, you know, seeing the United States is shifting from a liberator, which they do appreciate, to an occupier. If there becomes armed attacks by Shia extremists, then the United States faces very major problems here. Right now, it's only limited to one group.
We also hear today that an F-16 has gone down in Iraq and its pilot has safely ejected, in addition to the Apache helicopter that came down. What do you know about the F-16?
The helicopter was shot down by hostile fire. The F-16, we've been repeatedly told, was basically just a crash due to a mechanical failure. That occurred southeast of Baghdad, and it's an area where there has not been clashes. Again, all these operations and all the fighting and where the Apache went down is sort of the area to the north and west of Baghdad, the so-called Sunni Triangle.
David, can you describe the U.S. operation there? They've got a lot of soldiers involved, and as you describe it, fairly heavy air power as well. Are they encircling an area and then searching every home, or exactly what are U.S. troops doing?
There's two separate operations. The first one was known as Peninsula Strike. That was just north of Baghdad, about 35 miles from the city. And there they surrounded a peninsula that was three sides of the Tigris River, winds its way around this piece of farmland. And they did use 4,000 troops to seal off the area. There were patrol boats on the rivers that actually chased down one boat that was fleeing that had guns and ammunition in it. And then American troops went through and they searched houses in that area. There were very angry complaints from Iraq in the area that it was a heavy-handed operation. Iraqi said that women and children were handcuffed along with men while the searches were done. American officials denied that. So that's one operation. The second operation, which is ongoing, is northwest of Baghdad, and that's a bombing last night by an F-16 of what was being called a terrorist training camp by American officials. That's in a more isolated location. And apparently, troops from the 101st Airborne are attacking that camp. And that's where the Apache was shot down. That operation is continuing, and the military is saying very, very little about that and not even disclosing the location of it at this point.
What's the speculation, I guess, at least, about what they mean by a terrorist training camp? Is this domestic Iraqis or something else?
The majority of people in the... they're being very cryptic about this. The majority of the people in the camp appear to be loyalists to Saddam Hussein and his regime, but the senior officials have said tonight that some of the people in the camp were foreigners. There has been some indications of religious extremists joining forces with the Ba'athists, some religious fundamentalists carry out the attack on Americans, but the main group continues to be Iraqi members of the intelligence services here, former military people who are carrying them out, but there is a mix of people here, some foreign religious extremists who've come here as, a way to attack Americans.
David Rode, the Iraqi National Congress leader, Ahmad Chalabi, has been quoted saying that Saddam Hussein remains alive in Iraq, north or west of Baghdad, and that he is offering $200 to anyone who kills an American. Is this seen as a credible claim?
According to both military and American diplomats here, it's not a credible claim. There have been, you know, long-running stories of bounties being offered for Americans here. American officials say they don't have it. You know, they say they wish they did. They wish they knew where he was, or they wish they could confirm that he was dead.
David, have you had a chance to speak with the U.S. troops? How do they feel about the situation that they're in now, the situation they're confronting in Iraq?
Some of them are very tired, and I think their sense is that there's a small number of people carrying out these attacks, and they can, with some of these aggressive operations, arrest these people or kill them. These attacks should eliminate some of the people who are carrying out the ambushes, but the real question is will it shift the broader public opinion against the American presence here? Will the United States be seen as heavy-handed, and will the United States be seen as an occupation power, which it is here? Iraqis are increasingly talking about being frustrated about not having their own ability to run the government here or anything in the government, and the heavy-handed American tactics, some of them say, will simply turn the broader population, which vehemently opposed to Saddam Hussein, that it will turn the broader population against the Americans.
David Rode, thank you for joining us at a very late hour from Baghdad.
Thank you very much.
David Rode is a correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad, Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld said that rebuilding and restoring order in Iraq would be slow going, and it is slower and more costly in lives already than many Americans foresaw. Rebuilding a country after tyranny and war is not easy. But U.S. planning for the defeat of Saddam Hussein appears to have been far more effective than its plans for rebuilding Iraq. And in the catch-up game, Americans are dying. Can you see the path to a peaceful, rebuilt, democratic Iraq? Are we on it? Is America still at war? For how long? Do you have friends or a family member on duty with U.S. forces in Iraq? What are they telling you about the job there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon is Neil. Kenny Geyer, CEO of Mercy Corps, one of five NGOs awarded a contract by USAID to help rebuild Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Neil Kenny Geyer.
Good evening. Delighted to be on your show.
It's good to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Neil Kenny Geyer, I know you've been very recently in Iraq and will soon be there again. Where have you been active and what have you seen? How is this occupation going?
Well, Mercy Corps has been active in terms of humanitarian assistance, and now we've turned our attention to some early reconstruction. We've been active both in the south and in the north. I was just there about a week ago, and I wanted to go see our team that has been there since mid-April to, number one, say thank you for the heroic work that they've done, number two, to see the circumstances for myself, and number three, to make sure that we're on track in terms of our programs.
So they're out there and they're working, but Neil Kenny Geyer, is this an effective occupation, an effective reconstruction effort, in your professional view?
Well, it's certainly not as fast as anyone would like. As you started out, I think everyone, in hindsight, would say way more planning went into winning the war than went into winning the peace. That having been said, it is a really tough environment. It's still insecure, as the reporter reported. It's very hot. Electricity is out many, many places. That complicates sewage and sanitation. There's not enough clean water. And in some areas, food's running out. So it is a tremendous challenge, and we all wish we were much further along at this point, especially the Iraqi people.
Neil, how many countries has Mercy Corps done work in?
38 countries right now.
Have you ever seen a more difficult challenge than what you're facing in Iraq?
Well, when I look at our work in Rwanda and I look at our work in Afghanistan, those are serious, serious challenges. But I think what complicates Iraq is the fact that we still have a void. We have a vacuum in which there's no public services, no police, no one really in charge at this point with whom we can work and start to do the kind of activity, do the kind of programs that will have long-term results. But there are plenty of challenges around the world, and Iraq ranks right up there.
I'd say, Jack Beatty, have you been following this? It's tough news out of Iraq. The head of U.S. ground forces there saying today that the country will be in combat zone for some time. Paul Bremer today banning anti-American activities, gatherings, pronouncements, or publications that incite disorder. Not an easy picture.
Not an easy picture at all. And our friend Peter Galbraith, who's been on our program several times, former ambassador, testified before the Senate today about this occupation, how it's going. And he said, quote, "The administration did almost no planning." He speaks of miscalculations, rookie mistakes. He says the inability to establish any authority in the region and the resulting unchecked looting and damage has had a huge psychological and political impact. Finally, he says the early mistakes were so huge, we'll probably not recover. That's Peter Galbraith, the Iraq expert, testifying.
Not recover? What would that mean?
Well, I think what he means is that this may be a kind of tipping point. We heard this before when the occupation began, that there can be a point here where you alienate people and you simply can't get the support after that. I think that may be what he's talking about.
Let's hope we are not there. We're going to dig into this tonight. We're looking at occupation under fire in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Can you see the path to a peaceful, democratic, rebuilt Iraq? Are we on it? Does this feel like a quagmire? or the unavoidable birthing pains of a nation being reborn. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about occupation under fire in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Is this what you expected in a post-war Iraq? Is this post-war Iraq? And do you have friends or a family member on duty with U.S. forces now in Iraq? What are they telling you about the job they're doing there, the job that remains to be done there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Neil Kenny Geyer, joining us from Portland, Oregon. He's CEO of Mercy Corps, one of five NGOs awarded a contract by USAID to help with the rebuilding of Iraq. And now, joining us from New York, Michael Weisskopf, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Michael Weisskopf.
Good morning. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. Michael, you've seen the kind of flood of news out of Iraq in recent days, the big operation underway right now, 4,000 or more U.S. troops in one operation north of Iraq, another northwest of Iraq just launched today, a U.S. helicopter down there. How do you read what's going on, that we've got this central area of conflict, the so-called Sunni triangle, more stability, we're told, in the north and south? On balance, how is this effort going?
Inconclusively on balance, and I would guess in the long run we'll mop it up, but we probably cut off hostilities too quickly back 8 or 10 weeks ago when the military effort ended. Didn't look far enough afield for where all those Republican guards and Baathists went who kind of disappeared off the firing line. You recall there were predictions of a very strong opposition resistance defense of the Capitol,
right,
that all melted away.
Mm-hmm.
Time and others did stories about that, and we even did a reconstruction and discovered that nobody was in their tanks when the Americans arrived.
So, Michael Weisskopf, at this point, what do you think we're looking at? Did those troops melt away into what is now being seen as this Sunni heartland north of Baghdad, and with a truckload of cash, and they're reconnoitering there and pushing back? I mean, there are pretty steady and fairly well-organized attacks on U.S. forces. There are very frequent deaths. Have we still got a kind of holdout bastion in the middle of the country?
Yes, I think, I visited many tanks in post-war Iraq, and they were abandoned, and there were uniforms within a few feet of the tanks, and their berets and everything. These were people who traded their guns for civilian clothing or had civilian clothing underneath. They took off and melded into the civilian communities, and now with the failure of the American army to consolidate political control there, very quickly, and because of the lack of basic services going on and the popular uneasiness there, it's possible to sort of stage a second effort.
Let's look at those other two other legs of this stool. You've got the military piece, which we've been talking about. There's the economy and the political angles as well. Michael Weisskopf, what do you know about the economy at this point? Is there an economy in Baghdad? Is it in Iraq? Is it working? Is there commerce? Are there salaries?
It's an economy that is a consumer economy only, in that there are commercial shops. Many, many of the factories of Iraq were looted and became shells and places where people could not report any longer, leading tremendously to the unemployment problem. The oil industry is just limping along. It also has been looted heavily. And it's operating at a small fraction of its pre-war output. So most of what's going on there is just the kind of exchange of money for food, blocks of ice, gasoline, and it's that type of economy operating on a consumer level only.
Neil Kenny Geyer with Mercy Corps, what have you and your people in Iraq seen on the economic front? There's not much activity now. Are there signs that it may pick up to the point where Iraq can return to something like normalcy, or is even that still somewhere off?
Well, I think in terms of the economy, I think we're a long way away from normalcy. As Michael reported, you know, I would guess in much of Iraq, 60% and 70% of the population are out of work. There is no production going on in virtually any sphere, any area. What is saving Iraq right now is the fact it's a tribal society based on families, extended families, and they work very much together to support one another. There are a lot of Iraqis who live outside of the country that are sending support in, and the families inside of Iraq, the extended family, does everything it can to support its own. And so that's the key right now. But you see all during the day, you see many, many people out in the streets just walking. The only shops that you see open, especially in the South, are those that sell food and basic supplies and goods. But that's about it.
And Michael Weisskopf, what about on the political front? Neil Kennegeier has described what his people see in Iraq. No one in charge, no public services, few or no police. There was a lot of talk about Iraqis taking over weeks and weeks ago now. That hasn't happened, and the date for that has been pushed off and finally kind of, as far as I can tell, dropped as an idea. What's going on politically in this country?
Well, security is an enormous problem on a number of levels. On the street level, there are tens of thousands of former felons who were released from prison, both by Saddam and his general amnesty, and also by the liberation of prisons by the Americans. They are all armed because of the proliferation of guns on the street, and there is a tremendous rate of robbery that's going on there, and revenge killings. So that when I was in Iraq a couple of weeks ago, emergency rooms were filling up with 10, 12 times the number of gunshot victims they used to have before the war. And Americans, since I've left, Americans have doubled and redoubled patrols. But while I was there, there was very little action on the streets to sort of deter this kind of gunplay. And then, of course, there's the security on the larger level, which has to do with defense against guerrilla fighting. And we're seeing a reaction to that right now by American troops.
So we ask about politics, you respond about security. Are we to take from that there can't be a political life in Iraq until there's security? That seems a ways off. What we hear today from General McKiernan, that Iraq is still, what does he call it, will be a combat zone for some time. What about politics?
Well, clearly, politics is a really, that kind of consolidation must follow security issues. And it's been a moving target. The original plan was to provide spots for Iraqis in a provisional government very soon after hostilities ended. And because of the lack of consensus on who should take those jobs, there's been a decision to delay that and to use Iraqis only as advisors.
And so,
while the Americans continue to call the shots with the British as well.
Listeners, you can join this conversation. Did Washington see post-conflict Iraq through rose-colored glasses? Should the United States have been better prepared for the realities of post-conflict Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Good discussion, as usual. I think we have to recheck our perspectives here. I think Mr. Weisskopf is not being very candid about the fact that it basically is a military occupation. And let's be clear, a military occupation is an occupation and a subjugation of a people by force. And therefore, none of us should be surprised that democracy cannot flourish under the gun.
And but Jay, this was presented as a liberation, and we saw many Iraqis receive it, not all, but many receive it with some joy on that front.
Well, you're right. The word is presented as a liberation.
Well, come on. Saddam Hussein was nobody's ideal of a great leader. Presumably people are glad he's gone.
No one loves Saddam, but bidding Saddam farewell does not mean that what replaces him is necessarily even a pretense at democracy. And I think the press, especially the American press, I think, is doing a rather poor job of buying into. I mean, it's basically buying into this vision of the administration that it is possible to actually foist democracy or any kind of liberal democracy as we know it in the West by this kind of action. I mean,
but it's seen as a gift. But Jay, we take your point. Neil Kinnegar, let me put that to you. First of all, on the face of the U.S. presence there, does it have the feeling of a liberating presence? And are your people describing it to you as seen by Iraqis as a kind of, I don't know, comrades who will lead them toward democracy?
Well, I can speak more in terms of the South. And in terms of the South, it does not feel like an occupation because it's such a low-key presence. You mm-hmm. do not see very many patrols. You have to look hard to see the presence of coalition forces in places like Al-Quds, Diwaniya, Najaf, and elsewhere. And in terms of the Iraqis that I spoke with, what has confused them the most is they saw this overwhelming military force come in with incredible technology and achieve such a victory so quickly. They're completely confused and skeptical of why can't we get the electricity back on? Why can't we get clean water flowing into homes? Why can't we get something like the economy going for them? Most of them were way more focused on that than in terms of looking at the U.S. or the coalition as an occupier.
And they're waiting to see that happen in spite of the tremendous national power they saw demonstrated militarily. Jack Beatty, it's a checkered picture here. Some stability in the South, some progress in the North, an awful lot of resistance in the center of this country, and I think a general sense that this somehow has to be accomplished.
Yes, and, you know, in some ways we have the disadvantages of an occupation, that is, inevitable resentment and friction and perhaps even violence, without the advantages, and that which is to restore and secure order. And that really traces back to the decision raised by General Shinseki last February that we needed 100,000 more troops than we have there today. And the Pentagon said no, and they're sticking by that. And I have heard from reliable sources known to us that Pentagon planners are in despair over this, because they have recognized all along that Shinseki was telling the truth, that that's what was required to secure the fruits of an occupation, which is to create order, but that the administration has its plan A, and it ain't switching to plan B.
And so there may not be enough resource in the pipeline, you're saying, to make it happen, at least to make it happen in a timely way. I want to welcome into our conversation now Mahdi Albassam. He's a practicing cardiologist in Houston. He's a founding member of the Iraqi National Congress, recently in Iraq on INC business to look at the medical delivery system there. Good evening and welcome, Mahdi Albassam.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. The INC was a major voice in the pre-war period, describing what could be in Iraq, what might be afterward. Is post-war Iraq, if we can call it that, turning out to be what you and others in the Iraqi National Congress hoped for, Mahdi Albassam?
What we had hoped for following the liberation of Iraq was a quick establishment of a transitional government so that we could from there go into democratic voting and a constitution in Iraq. The delays that have occurred, although understandable, are not what we were expecting or hoping for.
So do I hear sour grapes here? Because your leader, Ahmed Talabi, has been, we read at least, a bit shunted aside. Did he want to step right into power? Was that your expectation?
No, I don't think Dr. Talabi is willing to get into a transitional authority that would be brought in by an outside force. He would only come to power if he was voted in. So I think that question is out.
Let me ask you this then. As we sit here tonight, do you feel confident that this American occupation is headed toward a successful conclusion in Iraq, however difficult it may be?
I think the American occupation will find its way towards a successful resolution of the situation in Iraq. We have proposed to the Americans on the ground that they would train an Iraqi police force. That would be a police force that would come in and establish law and order. Security is still, as Mr. Weisskopf said, a primary concern and probably the major concern right now in Baghdad and in most of the country. We definitely have remnants of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and his supporters who are waging a war of destruction against the infrastructure of the country and against the American forces present in Iraq. And this is what y'all have been observing and commenting upon. I just returned from Iraq, and it is very clear that the overwhelming majority of Iraqis welcome the liberation.
And Paul Bremer was seconding the notion today that there's still a strong Ba'athist group there really pushing back. Angel's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Angel. You're on the air.
Hi. Good show.
Thanks.
I'm just calling with a bit of a taste of the morale of my brother, who's only been over in Baghdad for a month.
Okay. What do you hear?
Well, we just got his letter Monday, and it sounds like him and his light cavalry unit are in pretty good spirits. I think really they're just happy that they're finally getting to do their job, and most of them signed up after September 11th, so I think they feel as though they're helping.
What's your brother doing day-to-day, Angel? Do you know they're in Baghdad?
Well, he wasn't able to give too many specifics, but basically he told us that he and his boys are sent out usually daily to certain areas to find and arrest loyalists in the city.
Mm-hmm. So tough work and dangerous work, I'm sure, but you're saying morale is high there. Thanks for reporting in. Michael Weisskopf, what do you know about morale among U.S. troops? Some of them have been there an awfully long time now. You've got National Guard units doing fairly dangerous patrolling duty that they may not have anticipated there, maybe more than patrolling duty. How's morale?
I saw different faces of it. I saw very easy interaction with Iraqis at some checkpoints, and I also saw very raw and short tempers for Iraqis who are, for instance, protesting or not moving along as quickly as they should. So it really depends from place to place. It's beastly hot there now, 120 degrees, and the sun is searing. These are men and women who are wearing large pounds of clothing and
Kevlar
and
body armor, the works.
Yes, and it must be terribly uncomfortable. They're people of great bravery, great valor, and great public service. And many of them didn't sign up for this.
Nothing like an easy job.
No, and it's fairly remarkable. And I imagine it runs a gamut. Some of them have been in the region for 9 months and are ready to go home.
They must surely be ready to go home. Mario Bossom in Houston, Texas, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mario Bossom is a founding member of the Iraqi National Congress. We're talking tonight about occupation under fire in Iraq. Can you see the path to a peaceful, democratic, rebuilt Iraq? Are we on it? Does the United States have the ability, the determination to make Iraq a shining example of democracy in the Arab world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about occupation under fire in Iraq. My guests are Michael Weisskopf, senior correspondent for Time magazine, joining us tonight from New York. From Portland, Oregon, Neil Kenny Geyer, CEO of Mercy Corps, one of five NGOs awarded a contract by USAID to help rebuild Iraq. And our own Jack Beatty, you can join the conversation as well. Can you see the path to a peaceful, democratic, rebuilt Iraq? Are we on it? And with the drip-drip of American casualties there, how many American lives is the reconstruction of Iraq worth? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mudafa is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudafa. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm first rejecting the statement by the ANC gentleman that Iraqis look to the American army or coalition army as liberator. They are not. Reality is so obvious for them that they are an occupying army. They are doing the most important things for their interest, which is securing the oil and controlling politically, economically, the whole region.
So, Mudafa, we can see from your disagreement with Mari Al-Bassam, people might debate that. But let's just say for a moment that you're right. What's the significance of that in terms of the U.S. occupation and its goals?
I would say it's into so many phases. This is the first resentment with the Sunni triangle, which I disagree calling it Sunni as much as I would call it Saddam's allies.
Yeah, this is Saddam heartland.
Yeah, and they will be crushed. I mean, because they are defending just their own interests. But there are some people there who think in national way that Iraq is under occupation. The other thing is they're gonna have a problem with the Shiites later on because they are not allowing Iraqi people to choose for themselves. So any terms of liberation is not applied there. I mean, if people cannot decide for themselves, there is no sense of all talk about liberation or democracy.
So we're hearing that both ways tonight, but we've got your view on it. Thanks for your call. Neil Kennegeyer, what about this issue? I mean, as we watch from afar, we hear the top general talking about combat going on for some time. We see the American deaths, even aircraft brought down today. There's this kind of instinctive fear in the back of the mind. Oh, my gosh, what are we into here? Is there confidence in Iraq among the aid agencies there, among your crew, among Iraqis, as far as you know, that order will eventually be brought? Or is there a real risk that, you know, those truckloads of cash that we see disappearing or disappeared and all those missing troops could be the fodder for a real long-term, I don't know, guerrilla war?
Well, I think we hold mixed feelings. One, where because we're humanitarians, we're cautiously optimistic, and we know that the Iraqi people are very resilient. Mm-hmm. It's a highly educated group of people, technically very advanced, and so you've got all of the potential with the oil resources to really rebuild Iraq in a wonderful way. On the other hand, it's enormously complicated. You have the emergence of all sorts of political parties, all kinds of different groups vying for power, vying for influence, some from Iran, some homegrown, and it's a very confused environment. The Iraqis that are part of our team, and many of the Iraqis that I spoke to, are just like people everywhere. They were cautious about all these new groups, cautious about the occupation, but hopeful that in the very near future they would get security, that the schools would function again for their kids, that the electricity would be back on most of the day, that they would have clean water to drink. And in my view, if we can just restore those basic services and begin to give people hope in terms of the economy, they will find a way to sort out the complex politics.
Michael Weisskopf, let me put the same question to you. Is eventual stability in Iraq a foregone conclusion, or is there still a real fear of a kind of long-term, hot or warm guerrilla campaign there?
I think that it will always be fraught with the risk, not only because of the Ba'athists, but because of the large splits within the peaceful community of Iraq, and that is, you know, the regional splits, the ethnic splits, religious splits. And we haven't talked at all about the looming importance of the Shia as a political force. And you do see emerging from the grassroots a real kind of political organization, effort to reach way beyond the mosque to the political organization in that country by the Shia.
And you're suggesting with that a kind of a Islamic government movement?
Well, potentially, or at least the pressure arising therefrom, and so you've got that, and a fearful Sunni community because of that. You have we've talked about the Kurdish issue in the north, and whether they will get significant and sufficient power to feel part of the process. So I think it's even in the best of circumstances. And probably in the way that American planners projected, it is a dicey situation politically. It need not be one as insecure as it's been with guerrilla warfare going on, but it certainly is one in which there will always be friction.
Janet's calling from De Pere, Wisconsin. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just called to say that I have a son that's in Iraq, and he's in the 101st Airborne, and he was able to call us about 2 weeks ago, and he confirmed very much about what your guests have been saying.
What was the word from your son, Janet?
Well, he's in Mosul, which is in northern Iraq.
Sure.
And he said they had only gotten electricity 3 days before he called.
Okay, so taking a while, but they had it.
He's been there since February.
Wow, a long time.
And so, you know, he said you can imagine how frustrated the Iraqi people are.
Did he sound optimistic about the direction of things, Janet?
Well,
could you tell?
Actually, he was calling to get information from us. He said the soldiers are getting very frustrated because they're not given any word about anything. So he called us to see if we heard anything about when they're going to be able to come home, you know, what's happening around other parts of the country. They don't know, and they're becoming very frustrated. And as your guest said, they're tired, it's hot. And he said what he does right now, they're staying in a missile silo. They go out for 7 days, they come back for 3 days, they go out for 7 days and work with the police and train the police, come back for 3 days, and they've been kind of doing that off and on since the war ended.
Life in a missile silo. Did he have any idea when he might be coming home?
No, he didn't have a clue. And that's what is making most of the guys a little upset, is because they don't have a clue.
Well, that's a position no soldier likes to be in. Janet, thanks for the report. Kay's calling from Boston. Hi, Kay, you're on the air.
Good evening. Like many Americans, my heart goes out to all the Iraqis who have endured Saddam's oppression for so long.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we all hope that the Iraqis will be able to put in place a pluralistic democracy someday. But in light of the huge challenges that are facing all parties to make things work, I keep asking myself, how can we help? What can we as Americans do to help the Iraqi people? So my question is really for Neil. Are there any major NGOs where monetary aid can go? What can we do? Who should we be looking at?
I'm sure many people are asking the same question, Kay. Thanks for voicing it. Neil Kenny-Geyer, in terms of donations, in terms of, I don't know, political activity, in your view, how could Americans on the home front be helpful with the effort there?
Well, it's a great question. Let me answer that in two ways. Number one, I think it is so important that our leadership, our political leadership, And I hope they do understand this, that we've got to be there for the long haul. There are no quick fixes and fast exits. And if we're going to succeed in Iraq, we've got to stay the course in terms of security, stay the course in terms of support, and muddle through as we go forward. So the first thing I would say is encourage our political leaders to keep the commitment. You know, we've seen the attention in Afghanistan wane, and we know that our political administration, no matter who's in power, often has a short attention span, but this is going to take a longer attention plan.
So keep everybody focused there. And more materially, what else? Anything else?
More materially, number two, there are some wonderful organizations who are doing great work there right now. Our own Mercy Corps, and one could go to our website. There's CARE, there's Save the Children, there's Oxfam, there's a whole range. And I would say pick one and get involved and make a difference.
Neil Kenny-Geyer, we're running short of time, but we hear what you're saying, and we wish you well with your work there. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be with you.
Neil Kenny-Geyer is CEO of Mercy Corps. He joined us from Portland, Oregon. And Michael Weisskopf, our time has gone so quickly, but we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Weisskopf is senior correspondent for Time magazine and recently back from Iraq. Jack Beatty, you heard there the plea from Neil Kenny-Geyer. He says, let's remember there are no quick fixes, no fast exits if we want this to go right. Is there any debate about that?
I don't know about that. I think there is some debate within the Bush administration. I mean, we have heard about the split between the nationalists and the neoconservatives. The nationalists, like Mr. Rumsfeld, want out as soon as possible. The neoconservatives want to turn this into a democracy. And, you know, there's a political clock ticking on this occupation. This isn't going to be good for the president if Americans are being killed in 6 months and a year.
No, it won't. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. In a moment, reflections from the wife of a National Guardsman now at the center of the fighting around Baghdad. This is On Point. the center of recent skirmishes in Iraq are two military police units from the Rhode Island National Guard. The National Guard is often associated with domestic floods and hurricanes, but thousands of guardsmen from Rhode Island and many other states now find themselves in a dangerous Iraq, far from home, and anything but weekend warriors. Jen Rose's husband, Edward, is a sergeant first class in the 115th Military Police Company, a Rhode Island National Guard unit policing Baghdad. In this radio diary, she says she never expected her husband to be called up to fight in a war.
When I married my husband, I did not really think that he was going to have to go away to war. If anything, I thought, you know, we've had peacekeeping missions. I thought maybe he'd be in Bosnia, he'd be in Kosovo, he'd be doing something like that. I know that he had been deployed in the first Gulf War, and I just never really thought that that would happen again. And going through it, living through it, it's a very, very sad, very scary thing. And you think of the National Guard, and you think, you know, weekend warriors, 2 weeks a year, 1 weekend a month, but it's the dedication that these people have to the National Guard is nothing like that. Yes, they have their 1 weekend a month. They have meetings during the week. And, you know, their 2 weeks of annual training sometimes leads to three. You just don't think that they're going to be called up to actually go to war. And you're going to be watching it on television and seeing exactly what war is all about. Yeah, you watch the movies, but it's nothing like that. The movies always focus on the glorified part of war, you know, things blowing up and heroes in the end. And nobody really focuses on the families, and nobody focuses on what the soldier is missing, births, deaths, things like that, that you don't see that type of stuff. And when you're married to a National Guardsman, you don't think that they're going to be missing that. You think you can buy a house and have children and get married and, you know, everything's going to be fine and that it's not going to be interrupted for a year. When he first went over there, that's all I did. I just sat there and I watched the news and I worried every day and I didn't sleep at night and I didn't eat. And finally, I just had to shut the TV off. I had to make that decision that, you know, no news is good news. So as long as I had nobody in uniform showing up at my door, I knew he was okay. Now, all of a sudden, nothing's on the news anymore. You know, the only thing that you're hearing on the news now is you are hearing about the attacks, you're hearing about the ambushes, and you're hearing about the soldiers dying. And one soldier dying affects thousands of families because you don't know if that's your soldier. And it's the worst feeling in the world. The other night, actually, we were informed that there was going to be a news broadcast. And when we were watching the news broadcast, we found out that two Rhode Island units had actually been involved in an ambush. And it was a night of no sleep, wondering if your doorbell was going to ring or if, you know, somebody was going to be calling you up just to let you know that it was your soldier. Everybody keeps talking about when they're coming home. You know, we have some people saying that they're coming home in July. We have some people saying, you know, September. Their orders say 365 days, and there's no talk through higher military channels of that changing. We hope for their return as soon as possible, but realistically, we need to focus on 365 days, which would be in February, that they would be home in February. So we need to prepare ourselves to face the holidays alone without them. You know, it's only been 118 days now, and that's not even halfway through of when they're supposed to be gone. Every morning I go and check the previous day off my calendar. I'd rather count the days he's been gone than start at 365 and count down. It just seems, you know, a lot nicer to be counting from one and up. You have to count every day, at least I know I do, because it just lets me know that the time is growing shorter, that he's going to be away.
Jen Rose lives in Cranston, Rhode Island. Her husband, Sergeant First Class Edward Rose, is currently stationed with the 115th Military Police Company in Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is